Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And joining us now, all the way from Australia, is the author of the book, The Family, and it's called, and he is Chris Johnston. Thank you for being on the show.
That's a pleasure.
First of all, Chris, so now you're a journalist. How did you get into writing about the family?
Well, I was working for a newspaper here in Melbourne, Australia, and I've been covering various things to do with, I guess, quasi-religions, groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses, various cults and sects, and also which you've also had in the United States, we had a big series of inquiries into the Catholic Church and their treatment of child sexual abuse. And I was kind of like, I got myself sort of engrossed in that sort of world in terms of reporting, and I guess one thing led to another, and I started to wonder whatever happened to this notorious Melbourne-based cult of the I guess 60s, 70s, and 80s. This was about, I don't know, 2014, and I started to go through all the newspaper archives and started to make a few calls to figure out where it was at now, and discovered back then that there was an awful lot happening, and there were stories there to be written for the newspaper on, I guess, the aftermath of this thing that had happened here. And one thing led to another, and a few years later we had a book.
Well, that's interesting. Now, how did this family or so-called family start?
So it started. It started essentially from the mind of one woman who became the cult leader. Her name was Anne Hamilton Byrne, and she was from a country town near Melbourne. She was from a dysfunctional family. Her mother was a paranoid schizophrenic who died in a mental hospital. Her father was a kind of itinerant, failed soldier. And she, through a process of reinvention sort of emerged as a sort of a yoga teacher in the very late 1950s here in Melbourne, just as yoga was sort of becoming a thing. And through her yoga classes, she began to collect a bunch of, I guess, hangers-on, and she started to sort of infuse her yoga classes with a sort of a cod spirituality, and she started to realize that she could exploit some of the people who were coming to her yoga classes, and that's what she did. And they were in the main sort of wealthy middle-aged women from the more well-to-do parts of Melbourne, and soon enough she had a following, and one thing led to another, and she started to sort of increasingly meddle in these people's lives and manipulate them for her own ends. And this was, you know, this was before she started stealing children. I guess it started innocently enough with this woman who, you know, always had potential to, start exploiting vulnerable people, and soon enough through yoga she did. So this was the very late 50s.
So she must have had a charismatic personality.
Yeah, she was charismatic and beautiful. Some people say she looked like a sort of a young Kim Novak. She was blonde. She was statuesque. She put on the airs and graces of someone who sort of mixed with the upper classes and with the elite, but in fact she wasn't, but she, the way she reinvented herself around about the sort of Second World War time, around about the 1940s into the 50s, the way she reinvented herself then was, you know, into this sort of educated, noble woman, I guess, which she in fact never was, but she managed to convince a bunch of people that that's who she was.
Now, so did she start preaching to them, sort of, or was it just a club, or teaching yoga and giving them little hints of what they should do, and how did she get that from that to getting money and things out of them?
So she slowly started sort of drip feeding this sort of like plagiarized spirituality. So bits of Buddhism, bits of Hinduism, bits of Christianity, bits of all kinds of a sort of mishmash of various sort of religious tropes. And she started drip feeding that into her yoga classes. And she started to see that the women at the classes could be manipulated really easily. And she started to grow wealthier. She, quite early in the piece, around 1961-62, she managed to convince a very eminent university professor in Melbourne, who was an Englishman, but he was in Melbourne at the time, a professor of physics named Rainer Johnson. She managed to convince him to come on board and essentially help her recruit adult members for this sort of growing cult, which by the early 60s had accumulated a bunch of property and had built itself a temple in the Dandenong Ranges, which is a little mountain range just near Melbourne. So this professor guy was, he was a professor of physics and he was really eminent. In fact, he worked with Ernest Rutherford in the UK, splitting the atom. But by the 1960s, he was at the sort of twilight of his career in Melbourne and had moved into a sort of metaphysical set of beliefs rather than physics. So he was interested in, he started writing books about, you know, the meaning of the universe and spirituality and reincarnation and stuff like that. And she literally turned up on his doorstep one day in December 1962 and convinced him that she was a true prophet and that she was the teacher that he had been looking for. And by the winter of 1963, they were doing, she was giving him LSD and magic mushrooms, and he was declaring her to be Jesus Christ.
Wow, what an impact she must have had.
By this time, she'd figured out that if you give people enough acid and psilocybin, then they'll hallucinate and they'll believe what you say. And the whole LSD side of this story takes a really, really interesting turn in around the mid-60s when the cult, as it was certainly by then, because by then they'd started accumulating children as well, but not only had they got themselves some children, they'd also got themselves a psychiatric hospital in Melbourne, where there was loads of LSD being used in therapy, which was legal back then, and she managed to infiltrate that and divert the supplies to her own cult and to use the psychiatric hospital as a recruiting ground for cult members. So it all escalated pretty quickly.
Well, how did she get access to the psychiatric hospital? Like, and how? She's not a doctor.
No, she's not a doctor, but she befriended a woman who owned this privately owned clinic. It was like a psychiatric clinic. So, in the late 60s, if you went to a doctor in Melbourne and said you were depressed or anxious or you had signs of, you know, schizophrenia or bipolar or some, all of those things, which not much was known about back then. It's the sort of place you'd be sent. And so she ingratiated herself into the life of the couple who owned it, and they became cult members. And then soon enough, the place was stacked with cult staff working there, because this was a cult that didn't attract the sort of the hippies or the flower children or the dropouts or the, I guess, the sort of outcasts of society. Like, if you think of something like Jim Jones and the sort of people that he went for, they were the poor and the vulnerable.
Right.
And the family didn't do that. She went for the rich, the influential, the white collar people, the professional. She loved doctors, nurses, architects, psychiatrists, lawyers. And as it turned out, these were just people that she figured could do things for her. So lawyers could make things happen for her. They could fake documents. Architects could build stuff for her. The psychiatrists could get all the LSD for her, which they were able to do back then because it was still legal in therapy. Yeah, so she amassed a whole bunch of enablers to help her out.
How interesting. I was just thinking that generally when you hear about cults, you automatically assume that they hook the, emotionally insecure or the vulnerable. It sounds like that's not what she was doing. She was going for those that did not seem vulnerable, but seemed to maybe help her with her goals.
I guess, at its peak in the sort of mid-70s, the cult probably had, I don't know, maybe 500 members here in Melbourne. Certainly there was a car park outside their lodge or their temple, which people described as having, maybe 200 cars there for a meeting. They had two meetings a week. So there were quite a few people, but I guess her inner circle were the enablers, were the professionals. But then in the sort of general cult population, there would have been some of those sort of more vulnerable types, but she certainly wasn't going for the sort of the street people or the sort of church rejects or the crazies. You know what I'm saying? She was going for people with means, definitely. And that's one of the reasons why she grew so wealthy, because she was able to she was able to get money from them, you know, to get donations and to amass property through her, you know, dodgy lawyers and real estate agents. And she had property in the United States and the UK, and we think she had property in Hawaii as well. So, you know, at one point she had real estate all over the world and was sort of zipping between her mansions. The most notable one was upstate New York, in the Catskills, in a little town there, where she was eventually flushed out in the 90s. So she held on to that property for a long time. And in fact, the cult's interests have really only just sold that property. That was maybe about 5 years ago.
What made her decide to start taking on children? Like, what was that, the reasoning behind that?
Well, I don't think anyone will ever know what the real reason was. Anne's dead, and when we were making the book, she died this year, a couple of months ago, I think it was July. She was 98. And when we were making the book, doing the book, she was in an old person's home with dementia. Now, we went in there, or we were taken in there by a contact to meet her. But she was in such an advanced state of dementia that to try and interview her or to get information from her would be both unethical and counterproductive, because she was in a sort of vegetative state. So as journalists, we could never ask her why she did it, why she began in the through the 60s and 70s, why she amassed a family of 28 children that none of whom were hers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she did through her life, she did offer various vague explanations, things like she loved children, she wanted a family, It was all very, very sort of vague and in that sort of language. But what we think from talking to people who knew her and from looking into her family background was simply that she grew up in a dysfunctional family, and she wanted to feel part of something. And she wanted to appear, she wanted to do anything she could to appear like a sort of a mother superior, like a sort of a benevolent sort of like mother figure, right? So through her cult members, who, like I said before, were professionals, lawyers, etc., she also had doctors and nurses and social workers in hospitals. And don't forget, in the 60s and 70s, adoption and the whole idea of being a single mother was, you know, people didn't think of it in the way they think of it today. It's normal today. It's an accepted part of society. But back then, you know, if a young woman unexpectedly got pregnant, she was often, you know, shipped away to have the baby, you know, on the quiet, or, you know, it wasn't accepted like it is today. And Anne was able to find out when and where single mums were having babies in hospitals, and she was able through her, it sounds unbelievable when you retell it, but she was able to, through her network of insiders in the hospitals, to actually go in there or send people in there and literally take them. So we heard stories, first-hand stories, of babies being born in hospitals to a cult doctor, handed to a cult nurse, who handed the baby to a cult operative who walked out of the hospital and gave the baby to the cult. Yeah. And she did this 14 times. She had 28 cult children. 14 of them were stolen in this manner, and the other 14 were usually the children of of cult adults, right? And the 14 that she stole, she gave her own surname at Hamilton Byrne, and she changed their Christian names, and she housed them in a sort of a compound beside a lake about 2 hours north of Melbourne. Mm. And the other ones, the children of cult adults, she didn't change their names, and she housed them in sort of cult houses with cult parents, sometimes their own, sometimes not, up in the hills near Melbourne in homes. So she sort of had them spread out. But the ones by the lake were, I mean, that's where all the really bad went down. I mean, they were imprisoned there, essentially. They were schooled there. They were dressed up identically. They were malnourished. They weren't fed properly. They were on a regime of pharmaceuticals to keep them docile. When they hit 14, they were dosed with LSD repeatedly as an initiation.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, so, and didn't they color all their hair like blonde, like that movie?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the main sort of defining image of the cult, and it's a photo that's used on the front of the book in a form, and it's a sort of Children of the Corn sort of piece of imagery where the kids at the lake house were they had their hair dyed blonde. Not all of them. 14 there, probably 10, 12 of them had their hair dyed blonde and cut in exactly the same sort of pudding bowl haircut. And they were dressed in sort of fine clothes, but it sort of was sort of like velour suits and stuff like that, and sort of lots of gingham and pinafores and things like that. It was sort of, she was trying to give the image over that they were, you know, highly educated, compliant, polite, wonderful children. And in fact, what they were being taught in the house was that they were a sort of a master race, and that in the next cycle of life, they would be the leaders, and they would become educated under her, and then they would educate the rest of us, you know, to continue the planet. So it was a sort of an apocalyptic, spiritualist, cruel, sort of imprisonment beside this lake.
Isn't there a rumor or a conspiracy theory that Julian Assange was one of these children?
Yeah, so it's both a rumor and a conspiracy theory. We researched the shit out of that, obviously, because look, for a while all signs pointed to him being there because he looks exactly like these kids. Mm. And what we found was that his mother was involved for a short time with a man who wasn't Julian's father. Mm. And he was, I wouldn't say directly, but indirectly involved with the cult. He was very much on the fringes of it as a participant for a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
And Julian's mum was actually trying to get away from this guy. So Julian and his mum never had anything to do with it. They were never involved in any cult activities. They were not part of it. Mm-hmm. Mum's boyfriend sort of was for a time. But it fits a conspiracist narrative to have him there. But yeah. I'm here to tell you that unfortunately he wasn't.
had to ask.
Yeah.
And now the LSD, what was the point behind that? And how did she tell the kids and the followers to take LSD? How did she get it into them?
Well, it was a mind control tool. So she figured out that people could become malleable under the influence of it and would be more likely to believe the outrageous things she was saying. So I was talking before about her key enablers. Her very, very inner circle, were able to do all sorts of things for her because of their positions in society, you know, lawyers, real estate agents, etc. But possibly her, one of her key guys was a psychiatrist who became involved with the cult. And he was such an eminent psychiatrist.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Psychiatrist in Melbourne, that he found himself in a position of being the guy who was advising the government, the state government here in Victoria, in Melbourne, on who should get licenses to use LSD in therapy. So the government said, okay, we'll give out X number of licenses to approved psychiatrists, and we'll bring the LSD straight in from Sandoz in Switzerland in liquid form, and you can be the guy who decides who gets to use it in which psychiatric hospitals as a sort of an experiment to see if it could work for mental health disorders. So the guy that was deciding how much LSD came in and who got hold of it was Colt. And so he obviously decided that he should get a bunch of it, and two of his cult mates who worked at the psychiatric hospital should also get a bunch of it. And it was coming in liquid form. And she was also using psilocybin, both from laboratories, same laboratories in Europe, and then later from just mushrooms, picked mushrooms. So she was right into psychedelics. Took them herself, but mainly dosed other people. And she would do things like, whisper in their ear, I'm Jesus, I'm follow me, I'm the truth, all this sort of stuff. She would have them in darkened rooms, and she would, there would be music playing, and she did the whole catastrophe, really.
About that kind of a person, like one of the things I have been researching with my stuff is psychopathic behavior and sociopathic behavior. It's definitely a complete lack of remorse for anyone else but her own desires.
Yeah, incredibly greedy. Narcissistic psychopath, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a woman who was so self-centered and so crazy that she, through her time as a cult leader, she mocked pregnancy 2 or 3 times. So she pretended she was pregnant. So that she could tell people that she was having more children. But to some of those around her, it was obvious that she wasn't. And also she was, you know, maybe in her 50s by then. And also that's a pillow under her dress, not a pregnant, you know, not pregnancy. And she was, one thing we found out during the research was that she had a cult woman making these sort of fake maternity frocks for her. So she was, on one level, she was prepared to just tell stupid lies about being pregnant when she wasn't. Mm-hmm. And at the other end of the scale, she was prepared to, you know, defraud the entire sort of state's sort of like health and adoption system in order to steal other people's children.
So now she had a husband that was involved as well, I believe.
Yeah. So Bill was her third husband. She went through quite a few husbands and men. She liked she liked ex-military guys. She seemed to treat her husbands in the same way that she treated her cult enablers. That is, use them and exploit them for what they could do for her. So Bill, who she is in fact buried next to, in Melbourne here in an old cemetery, Bill became, I guess, her key enabler and became a sort of a father figure to a lot of the children that they gathered at the house. We've obviously spent a lot of time with the child survivors who are now, I guess, sort of in their 40s. And some of them are doing great, some of them are doing not so great, and we obviously spend a lot of time with them. And, I mean, one of the things for them, was, particularly a couple of them, was that, you know, Bill was their dad. They thought Bill was their father, but of course he wasn't. He had nothing to do with them. He was just sort of complicit in taking them from the hospitals, but he wasn't their father. So there was this bizarre sort of like strange misplaced loyalty towards Bill because, he especially a couple of the girls actually, they were really close to him. And I'm thinking of one in particular, Leanne, or Anna as she was known in the cult. She said she was daddy's girl. She loved him. He loved her. She was, you know, she was his favourite, the apple of his eye, but also really cruel and manipulative, and obviously, as it turned out, not her dad. So they, you know, to this day, there's a lot of conflicted feelings and strange threads that they've yet to sort of tie up with all those emotions.
So how did it all end? How did it fall apart for Byrne?
So in 1987, the lake house was raided by the federal police and the state police, after two of the girls had independently escaped. Well, one escaped, the woman I was just talking about, Anna or Leanne, she literally escaped. So as the kids grew older, they were becoming more independent, and they were becoming smarter and started to realize that something was wrong. And that actually this life that they were living was really fucked up. And Leanne, being headstrong and sort of 16, 17 at the time, escaped. She tried to escape before, but she was successful. And she, one thing led to another, and she ended up talking to the police on the outside some months later. And she hooked up with another young woman who, with Sarah Moore, who was sort of the sort of leader of the kids, who had been chucked out of the cult, just before that. And the two of them hooked up on the outside, and one thing led to another, and they started talking to the cops. And then the cops, who, it must be said, had knew that funny stuff was happening for maybe, when was this, 87, for maybe 15 years. I think the first police questions were asked about this cult in 1971. 87, they were finally raided, and the kids were put into state care, and Anne, just before the raid, she didn't know about it, but fortuitously for her, had left the country, and a warrant was put out for her arrest, and then Bill left the country, and the two of them went on a merry dance through the UK and the USA and Hawaii, evading capture for 4 years. Interpol got involved, the FBI got involved, the Victorian State Police were involved. They were tracking their movements through airports. Eventually, and this is an incredible story, it's in the book, an FBI agent called Hilda Kogut, she was with one of the New York departments, I think, and Anne and Bill were hiding out in their mansion in the Catskills, and Hilda, being a good detective, got in the postal van, put on a postal uniform and went on the posties run, the post delivery run through the little hamlet, to suss out whether there was anyone in the house where they suspected Anne and Bill were, confirmed that they were there, and then the next day there was a raid at dawn with armed FBI agents who arrested the pair of them and put them in White Plains prison, and eventually they were extradited back to Melbourne, and they faced court on various minor charges in 1994. Now, the reason they only faced minor charges was that the police and the legal fraternity here in Melbourne, the prosecutors, the Crown, decided that the best way to get her back to Australia to face charges was to only slap minor ones on her. They didn't want to re-traumatise the children, the survivors. If she was charged with, for example, kidnapping, administering drugs to minors, she would have pleaded not guilty, and it would have been a lot harder, apparently, to get her back to this country. So they found some minor charges involving forging signatures on social security papers to do with some of the kids' identities, the name changes. They were the only charges in the end that they could get her on, because, like I say, this decision was made to not risk losing the extradition and to not re-traumatise the survivors by putting them through a court trial. So they were eventually found guilty of these minor charges and fined a paltry amount of money, and that was essentially the sort of the end of the cult as an active group of people. A few, you know, things continued a little bit, but and they still do to this day. But really, it's a benign sort of group now that doesn't do anything. And certainly when she was convicted and faced court, looking like a mere mortal, not like Jesus Christ, certainly her support sort of fell away, and she sort of retreated into the background, and then got sick and then died earlier this year.
And what happened to her husband?
Bill died in, I think, the early 2000s. He died of cancer. They're buried together in this little cemetery here in Melbourne. And there's a few things going on. One of the things we found out was that they have a bogus charity set up, a tax-exempt charity, to administer the money. They've been selling a bunch of their assets, including the house in the United States and some properties in Melbourne and the UK. There's this bogus charity is sort of like funneling the money around. We're sort of following the money trail at the moment. And there's a strong likelihood of a court action here in Melbourne, hopefully next year, around compensating or potentially compensating some of the survivors.
Hmm. Well, who runs the estate now?
A group of cult men who are sort of older guys who are the children of formerly senior cult members. So back in the day, like I was saying, she had all these lieutenants and enablers. Well, three of their kids who were, you know, guys in their 60s, 70s maybe now, they run the show behind the sort of veil of this fake charity, which we've tried to have investigated by the charities regulator, but they never have. But there is a legal team now looking at the paper trail in order to try and secure some money for the survivors. That's all up in the air.
Hmm. What do you hope that people get out of reading the book?
I think it's just that these things can hide in plain sight. Like, here's a story. Here's a story that spans, you know, 40, almost 50 years in Melbourne that all played out in plain sight. And it's really to do with belief and hope, isn't it? So here was a manipulative, narcissistic psychopath who somehow, like all cult leaders do, managed to persuade a bunch of people that she held the answers, and that they should believe, and that they should, there was something better, you know, there was an afterlife. They would follow me, and everything will be revealed, right? Mm-hmm. Which is sort of like the basis of all sort of religions, I guess. But here was someone who preyed on that, I guess, that sense of hope, and just managed to exploit hundreds of people and ruin a whole lot of lives just because of her own greed. And it happened right in front of us. And it happened with the you know, influential people were complicit in it. You know, it wasn't criminals or lowlives, although they did become criminals. It was members of the establishment. And you know, you can still see that playing out in cults today. You can still see it. I mean, look at Nexium. I mean, it's same but different, you know? It's kind of like, it's in plain sight.
It's amazing that it was so long ago. It's like they were the template for all these other cults.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, she, Anne Hamilton Byrne, she is a template. She's an archetype. The key difference with her is that she's a she. Most successful cult leaders, and I say successful in inverted commas, most of them that we could think of are men. Jim Jones, Manson, the Nexium guy. It's hard to think of an equivalent female cult leader. I mean, there are precedents, but then there's no one that anyone would have heard of. Hmm. I mean, you know, that's what made it unique. And in some ways, it's a kind of a twist. It's a fairy tale, because she was a sort of wicked witch character, and she had these innocent children, you know, innocent blonde children that she imprisoned in a scary castle sort of thing in the hills. So it had that fairy tale archetype thing to it as well, which sort of attracted us to the narrative.
Now, you guys, I say guys, you and Rosie Jones, now you guys did a documentary of this as well. Where can people find out more about you, the book, the documentary, and things like that? Do you have a website?
So The Cult of the Family. So just to clarify, Rosie's the filmmaker. I was around when the doco was being made, and we shared research for the project, but she made the film, but we wrote the book together. So when I was researching it, I found out that she was doing a film, so I went and met her, and we decided to collaborate. And she's made two films now. One was a cinema release, and one was a TV release here in Australia, 3x1 hour. And they're available online. And if I guess the best search would be Anne Hamilton Byrne, The Family, The Cult of the Family. Certainly the book's on sale in the United States. A pretty sort of detailed look at it. It spans right back from the 1920s and even sort of digs a bit before Anne was born into some of the ideas that she sort of leapt on, and some of her own family background and some of the cultural context that led to this happening. I mean, it's a sort of post-war story in a way, like, the sort of post-war suburban sort of conservative boom that happened in this country and in your country as well after the war, when the sort of middle classes and the upper middle classes sort of settled, and there was plenty of money going around, and people were starting to question things, weren't they, back then?
Yeah.
And getting into the 50s towards the 60s, questions started to be asked. You know, and so she was in the middle of that, exploiting people's sort of sense of wonder, I suppose, or sense of maybe even their sense of sort of questioning whether, you know, that post-war sort of thing was, you know, was that the answer, or was there a higher purpose? You know, that was the sort of cultural milieu.
Perfect timing from the 60s.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, the Maharishi plays a small bit part in this story, in that some foundation cult members went and saw the Maharishi in Melbourne. You know, there's real strands with other gurus from around the world who Anne met and tried to get involved with her own stuff, and it's a kind of a global story in a way. I mean, it played out mainly in Melbourne, and their base was certainly here, but there were tentacles all over the world.
Yeah.
Wow. And so the family's done now. It's not going anymore.
Well, some of the people are still alive, and like I say, there's this money flying around behind this charity, and there's various, they're offloading their assets. I mean, I think what they're trying to do now is offload or hide their assets before a potential class action, so that they're not as liable. That's just my theory. But look, she's dead. There's been no power play to replace her. There was sort of nothing to replace. She was, you know, she was inert. There was no worship. The temple which still stands, which Rosie and I went through, we were let in, because we had a cult inside, you see, who told us a bunch of stuff. A cult member, like one of her key supporters, decided to speak with us and to show us things. I don't know why, but he did. And he unlocked the doors of the lodge and showed us through, and he took us to meet her and all that. So, but no, they're not really, all they're doing now is I think, mitigating for any court action, you know. Because in the, I mean, what she's left behind, apart from all the victims and survivors, is just a bunch of greedy people who want what's left of her money. I mean, that's really what's happening now.
Yeah. It's too bad. Well, it's been a great conversation, and we recommend the book. We'll have it up on our website so people listening can just go one click, pick up the book. The book is called Awesome. Family. It's the shocking true story of a notorious cult, and the author, our guest, Chris Johnson. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
He's in.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.